Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is Nico Perez, co-founder of the streaming online service Mixcloud. First, let's talk about Aros. A-U-R-O-U-S. Today, Aros is the biggest threat to the music industry that there is out there, or at least that's how most of the music industry perceives it. The reason for that is Aros is very similar to GrooveShark, and they only just got GrooveShark shut down a few months ago. The reason why it was such a big deal was that GrooveShark was really just a shell on top of Google. When you would ask for a song to play, it would actually go out and search Google, and sometimes it found an illegally uploaded version of the song, and sometimes it found something that was legally uploaded. Anyway, it happened enough of the time where it was an illegal download, where no one got paid, that the major labels finally sued GrooveShark out of existence. They sued him for $750 million, and they won the judgment. And now, here comes Aros, which is a version of GrooveShark. It's not GrooveShark at all, but it does the same thing. And instead of searching the web, it searches the torrents. So now most of what it comes up with is illegal. And of course, this has the major labels in a frenzy because piracy's back if that's the case. What makes Aros particularly dangerous is the fact that it has a really cool interface that's very much like Spotify. So anytime you get something that's easy to use, that really freaks the major labels out. And it should, because now instead of people getting paid, they won't be. And if you think you heard a lot of reaction about the small payments from streaming, imagine what it will be when there's no payments coming from streaming. So this is a big deal. What ended up happening was Sony, Warner Brothers, and Universal Music Group sued Aros last week for copyright infringement. The problem is Aros is basically a decentralized BitTorrent search engine. So the company claims that it's not hosting any illegal content. And in fact, they have a point. So the real problem that we have here is, who is the judge going to believe? The RIAA, who's representing the major record labels, or Aros, the startup company that's encouraging piracy? Now, what's even more curious about this is Aros just came online the week before. So it was online essentially for 3 days before the major labels sued it. It was only in alpha, wasn't even in beta, wasn't even a full release when they sued it. So you can tell how paranoid the major labels are about the streaming service. So look out for more about this, because this will be a big deal in coming days, and it will be interesting to see who wins in the battle between the major labels and Aros. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks with a Small Studio. Go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. The next thing I want to talk about are the 10 songs that define America. The most interesting part of the 10 songs is the fact that this is the State Department's view. The State Department actually put out a pamphlet about the U.S. music scene and the indigenous musical genres. And what they claim is indigenous are jazz, blues, rock, disco, and rap. So they selected 10 songs that they felt represented America. Ready for the 10 songs? Here they are. Hellbound Train by Robert Johnson. Smokestack Lightning by Howlin' Wolf. So there's two blues songs. Ornithology by Charlie Parker. Well You Needn't by Thelonious Monk. And So What by Miles Davis. So there's three jazz songs. Crosstown Traffic by Jimi Hendrix. And No Fun by The Stooges. So there's two rock songs. And Sucker MCs by Run DMC. Follow the Leader by Eric B. and Rakim. Nothing But a G-Thang by Dr. Dre and Snoop Doggy Dogg. Those are the 10 songs that the U.S. State Department thinks define America. What do you think? First of all, I don't think that the State Department should get into the business of selecting 10 songs that looks like America. I don't even think that a lot of these choices really do justice to that 10-song list. But that being said, some of them are right on. Some of them are pretty good. What do you think? What's your thoughts? Tell me what your 10 songs would be. I can't even tell you what my 10 would be. It would take me a long time to only figure out 10. So I'm curious if you guys can come up with 10 songs that you think define America. Let me know. My guest today is Nico Perez, who's the founder of the online streaming audio website Mixcloud. Mixcloud allows for the listing and distribution of radio shows, DJ mixes, and podcasts that are crowdsourced by registered users. Its notable users include Wired Magazine, the Harvard Business School, TED Talks, and Barack Obama. I spoke with Nico via phone from New York City. Tell me about Mixcloud. It looks really interesting. So just give me an overview of it.
Yeah, for sure. So top line overview, Mixcloud is a platform for radio. We power the radio shows, DJ mixes, and podcasts for many different people, ranging from kind of bedroom hobby enthusiasts through to kind of global superstar DJs and radio presenters. It's a platform in the sense that anybody can upload to it and anybody can listen, and we don't take an editorial stance. We're also kind of open in terms of types of audio content. So it could be a lecture, a radio show, a DJ mix set, recording, whatever really is long format audio.
How did it come about? What was the genesis of the idea for this?
So the genesis was about maybe actually around 10 years ago now, myself and a few of the other co-founders, we had a college radio show at Cambridge University in the UK. And after graduating from college, we were looking for somewhere to kind of host the old shows and put up the archive. And at the time, there wasn't really any other options besides the iTunes podcast directory and, you know, usendit.com, like upload file share, places like that. So we really wanted to try and build something that was a little bit inspired by the iTunes podcast directory, but a little bit more kind of integrated into the web and something that worked with really kind of the social networks and things like that. So that's when we kind of set out to build Mixcloud. And so from the start, you know, we built it, you know, by radio presenters and radio DJs for radio presenters and radio DJs. It was really to kind of solve that frustration, that problem of somewhere good to host shows and DJ mix sets.
It's very cool. As a matter of fact, I should put my podcast on. You know, I was looking at it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was looking at it and I'm thinking, wow, why don't I know about this?
Yeah, absolutely. We have, at the moment, it's not a user-facing feature, but we have a feature in the back end where once you've set up a profile, we could actually link your podcast RSS feed to your profile, and it would kind of auto-populate every time you upload a new podcast, so you wouldn't even have to upload it separately. And then you could take that podcast and you could use the player to embed it around the web or wherever you wish.
That's cool. That really is. So I understand that you and your other founders bootstrapped this whole thing.
Yeah, that's right. So we're kind of a relatively rare in the kind of music startup world in the sense that we haven't raised millions of dollars and grown to be a huge, massive team. We're just 12 people based mostly out of London. I myself am based in New York since earlier last year. And we've pretty much entirely funded the company organically and grown it organically through the kind of different advertising channels that we offer on the site and some of the products that we offer to brands and people like that. So in that case, we're quite unique and actually quite proud of how far we've come just by ourselves.
No kidding. I mean, that's totally unique in this day and age. But, you know, it's actually one of those things where I think it's really important that especially in the music space, where licensing mm-hmm. is such a problem that it scared mm-hmm. a lot of investors away.
Mm.
So, you know, you haven't had that problem.
Oh, no, we have had that problem. I mean, that's part of the reason why we haven't raised. It's because, you know, a lot of investors are very scared of the music space and all the kind of different issues surrounding it. And so we've been very fortunate in the sense that we've worked with some really top lawyers to get the licenses that we have in place. So in the US, Sound Exchange, AFCAB, BMI, CFAC, in the UK, PRS and PPL. So, you know, that took a lot of work there. And nevertheless, investors are still kind of very apprehensive about the space as a whole.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. So that being said, what's your revenue model?
The revenue model is really built around advertising. So if you visit the site, you can see that there's display advertising. At the moment, we don't run audio ads yet. We may look to do that in the future. And really, besides the kind of classic display banners and things like that you see, we're trying to do more integrated advertising. And what I mean by that is essentially helping brands to create their own profiles and curate a series of radio shows or DJ mixes, often with very high-profile DJs that really kind of are more add more value to the kind of whole ecosystem rather than being a sort of interruptive ad. So we've helped people like Red Bull, Absolut Vodka, Adidas, and people like that to create radio shows and DJ mixes and kind of really get in touch with the kind of younger youth and millennial market.
Is that your demo?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely skew younger, so 18 to 34-year-olds is our larger demo. And we also skew a little bit more towards dance and electronic music than, say, pop or rock or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. When I looked around the site, it seemed very DJ-oriented. But when I speak with you talk more on the radio side.
Yeah, it's true. I think that has a lot to do with our kind of history and then on the flip side, our kind of ambitions. So historically, we have come from DJ backgrounds and have a very large network in the DJ space. And so historically, the site has always been very strong and there's a very large kind of electronic dance music community on the site. Nevertheless, there are kind of ambitions for the wider service are to be very kind of genre agnostic and be open and support all different types of genres, not only just in music, but across talk as well. So whether it be business or sports or comedy or things like that. And really try to sort of build a platform that works for different types of audio curators, whether in music or talk sense.
Mixcloud doesn't seem to have, don't take this the wrong way, it's the visibility factor as compared to a lot of other services. And you know what I mean? And I understand, considering that, you know, you don't have millions of dollars to spend on that. And actually what you're doing is tremendous. It's just, you know, I look at you in awe, the fact that you can pull this off and do it so well. That's, you know,
thank you very much.
With no outside money. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
But that
I think we definitely have a lower profile at the moment.
Yeah.
But I feel like that is definitely changing. You know, the last year or so, I think a lot of people have come to recognize what we do, how we're different from some of the other platforms out there, how, in fact, we do pay royalties. And, you know, that's definitely important when you're curating other people's music. And so hopefully, you know, as time goes on and progresses, people will recognize Mixcloud more and more as a place for hosting mixes and radio shows where you're kind of curating other people's music or ideas.
Have you had a deal with the major record labels for licensing?
No, we don't do deals directly with major record labels because we're a radio service. But we do deals with collecting societies. So, for example, the Sound Exchange in the U.S., they pay the Sound Exchange, and subsequently they pay to the major labels or independent labels as well.
Yeah, I see. Okay, I get it. I get the difference. So,
yeah.
When you first started, what was the overall ambition that you had? Were you looking to, did you have like a big goal in mind that you're still on the path towards, or did it evolve over time?
In terms of, you know, the ambition and the vision, you know, it did, being honest, start out quite small. We were just looking to build the kind of legal platform to host our radio shows and DJ mixes on. But it's definitely evolved over the years, and now the vision is a very large one in terms of really kind of rethinking radio with a capital R, and, you know, transitioning it from a model where, you know, it's based off of distinct radio stations and local geographies playing out music over AM or FM channels, to one where it's online, it's international, it's built around some of the social networks on the web and the fabric of the internet. It's all over IP rather than, you know, traditional FM or AM. And it involves much more of a kind of one-to-one relationship between the listener and the radio presenter or DJ. And so the broader vision is really to make radio more democratic, more social, and more personable. So there's a lot of kind of overlap with services like what Pandora do, but at the same time, you know, we very much focus on human curation and a human curator rather than algorithms. And so we place a lot of importance on that and on this idea that actually people are much better at curating music or ideas than algorithms.
Yeah, you know, radio has changed so much over the years, and not for the better in terms of, I don't know about the UK. Well, the UK is a different animal because of the BBC there, but here, just the fact that local radio has kind of dried up in, you know, in lieu of station groups and consultants, it's really changed the whole feel of not only radio, but music as well.
Absolutely. I entirely agree. And we have a kind of pseudo tagline, a funny pseudo tagline that goes, don't hate the radio, be the radio. Mm. And really what that's meant to say is, like, you know, we're very frustrated as well with kind of traditional commercial radio, which plays the same, you know, 25 songs 70 times a day on repeat for 2 weeks. And, you know, that's a very kind of, I guess it works in some cases, but actually it kills a lot of the breadth and diversity of what's available out there to listen to. And so going back to that point that I was talking about in terms of democratizing radio, you know, our ambition is that, you know, rather than needing to sign up and join a large radio station and get sort of approved and vetted by the radio station's managers and have to play what's on their, you know, chart lists and things like that, with Mixcloud, you can sign up as an individual and really be very much more in control of what you're presenting to people.
Is that where you see radio going then? I mean, ultimately, do you see it changing like that?
Yeah, I think there will probably always be a large component of, you know, people who just want to listen to top 40 popular hits. But I think that the power of the internet, and you've kind of seen this across many different media formats, is that the long tail actually can grow even longer. And so if you take Amazon, for example, I know that their long tail in terms of books has definitely grown over the years. And they're able to kind of reach more people who are interested in those kind of niche, kind of diverse, small areas and pockets that probably would never have been able to be served through sort of traditional radio.
I read a survey a week or two ago, and I'm trying to think of what it was. It might have been Music 360, which is the annual Nielsen report. But one of the things that was interesting was the fact that it was talking about radio as it is right now, traditional radio, is more powerful than ever in terms of the number of listeners and the number of people that were discovering new music, which is kind of hard to believe considering, you know, how limited the playlists are. But, you know, that being said, it's like, okay, if people are still listening to traditional radio, it makes you wonder if they're actually looking for something else. So what do you find?
I mean, it's a good point. I haven't seen that report, so I can't comment specifically on it. But I do know that at least in the UK, for example, there is still a huge population listening to traditional radio, but it's an aging population. And actually, the youth and millennial market are very quickly dropping off of tuning into traditional radio. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of tuning in online to different music services online and moving away from traditional radio. And I think TV is starting to see that effect now as well. So I think that, you know, in America as well, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a similar parallel here where there's still a large market of kind of 34-plus-year-olds who still listen to traditional FM radio. But I think that amongst the youth and millennial generations, the idea of kind of tuning in FM or AM dial is starting to quickly become old-fashioned.
Yeah. It's funny because for a while, I was hoping that I'm older than you, and I kind of lived through the golden age of FM radio when no one was mm-hmm. making money there, so it was very experimental, and just the it was wonderful because you'd tune in to listen to a DJ for their tastes, and you kind of knew that whatever it was that they're going to play was going to be, and it would be, you know, wildly diverse, wildly different. But you would figure that, okay, I like this DJ, I like their taste, so I'll probably like it. And
absolutely. I mean, one of our heroes, one of the people we're very inspired by, is a BBC presenter by the name of John Peel.
Oh, of course, yeah.
I'm not sure if you're familiar with him.
Yeah.
But he definitely champions kind of new independent music of any kind. And that kind of really eclectic, broad taste, I think, is definitely something that is lacking in so many aspects of traditional radio.
What do you think about Beats One?
Good question. I think I'm actually fairly impressed with how progressive and forward-looking and kind of their selection has been very, I guess, not non-mainstream. So I'm very impressed with that. They're playing a lot of UK-based, quite underground music coming from the streets of London and things like that. So I definitely have to give them a lot of respect for that. Obviously, the challenge is that, you know, it's a single channel. And so for it to try and appeal to everybody is going to be very difficult. You know, for that to appeal to a soccer mom in Iowa compared to a kid on the streets of London is very difficult to do that with one single channel. But I definitely am very impressed by some of the people that they've lined up and some of the artists and DJs that they've brought in as curators. And I think that that's been really well done. And from what I understand, it's been very well received across the whole industry. So, you know, we definitely see Apple shining a spotlight on the importance of curation and human curation as a beneficial thing. I think it's a good thing for the industry because I think there's so many companies that are data and tech led and think that it's, you know, possible to solve all problems with data and technology. And sometimes it isn't.
Do you think though, it's too early to really make that decision? And I'm not disagreeing with you at all. I'm just kind of bringing up the being the devil's advocate, to so to speak. Where, for instance, when Beats Music came out, their big claim to fame was curation, human creation, and it didn't seem to catch on with people. And every time that this has happened with the service, where they push human creation, curation, it seems like it's a good marketing feature, but so far the jury's out as to whether it really is something that the public is looking for. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's true. It'd be hard to give an accurate answer without. I would love to be able to see within Apple Music what people are actually engaging with, whether it's, you know, the Beats One radio channel or, you know, the Kinect feature that they've developed, or just the straight streaming. My gut and anecdotal evidence suggests that actually Beats 1 is fairly popular. But, you know, it's really hard, tough question to answer without, you know, knowing the numbers. I'm sure Apple knows.
What's radio like in the rest of Europe, as compared to the UK and even a, you know, broader comparison, the US?
Yeah, I mean, it's in some respects quite similar to the UK. There's usually a national broadcaster along the lines of the BBC. So France has Radio France, Italy has equivalent, Spain does as well, I believe. Germany has a few too. And then you have your kind of commercial stations that range, usually a lot of them are actually owned by one of two main radio groups, Bauer or Global. And then besides that, you have community stations. There's one in London called NTS, which is Mixcloud and very popular. One in Amsterdam called Red Light Radio, that's really kind of pushing things forward. And I think that we're going to see more and more of those community stations, people kind of popping up and running, you know, local community stations that are based in a city, but actually can broadcast much wider than that through the power of the internet. Because ultimately the kind of technological equipment and setup that is required probably took, you know, 10, 20 grand a few years ago. Now you can pretty much do it with a laptop and you know, a couple of microphones. So I think that we're only going to see more of that, really.
So when you say a community station, you mean it's an online station and it's not a traditional broadcast station, right?
That's correct, yeah. Most of them are online only. I know that a few of them, are, in some cases, are trying to apply for an FM license. Or in the UK, we also have digital radio called DAB, applying for a digital license there. Most of them are fairly happy with being an online-only service.
How about college radio? And you're a product of college radio. And I'm not so sure what the differences are in the UK as compared to the U.S., but I know in the U.S. there's a real crisis there, and it's mostly because of the cost of what it takes to maintain a traditional broadcast facility. So all those programs are changing as a result, because a lot of the colleges are actually selling them off. So, you know, they, as a result, the college station becomes a you know, an online only station, and changes just the way it, you know, everything works. So is that something that you only see in the U.S., or is that happening in other places?
Not that I'm aware of too much. I know that at least in the U.K., I think college radio stations actually have a much smaller footprint than the U.S. My understanding, I don't know the U.S. market that well, but my understanding is actually some college radio stations have a fairly good kind of reputation for being a kind of more eclectic and diverse source of radio.
Yeah.
And it's sort of the same in the UK, but I think that their footprint and kind of listener audience are definitely smaller, at least in our station, for example. Anecdotally, you know, we probably at max volume would reach, you know, tens of listeners, not even hundreds, rather than, you know, thousands, which I imagine college stations in the States reach.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, you know, a couple things happened. The first thing that happened was college stations suddenly became a great source of new music for a long time, because, you know, obviously they were playing, the DJs were students, and they were reflecting the tastes of their fellow students of what they were playing. So it was when FM radio, the heyday of FM radio in the U.S. kind of died, that was the next bastion of creativity. And then the record labels kind of figured that out, and then they began to service the college radio stations. In other words, they pushed them real hard in promo. And as a result, a lot of those stations kind of lost their creativity. And as a result, they lost a lot of their audience as well, because the audience used to be primarily students. And now I think if you took, and I just read this not too long ago, where there was a study that found that most of the listeners for College Station are not on campus, they're off campus, which, you know, which is completely different of the way it used to work.
And when you said that the costs are unmaintainable today in some of the universities they're cutting them, is that the cost to have an FM license, or do you know what in particular is so costly?
It's the cost for the maintenance of the broadcast facility. So,
the actual rent and
it's a transmitter. Just keeping the transmitter going. There's some costs involved, on a yearly basis that I guess it's more than what the program is worth to them in terms of, what the revenue is. So as a result, they can actually make money by selling it off, and that's what they're doing in many cases. Mm. And, they still have the broadcast program in the colleges, but, it's different. And I think there's a different mentality, too. When you feel like you're actually broadcasting, you're doing FM broadcast or AM or whatever it might be, but it's traditional broadcasting, I think there's a different state of mind that goes with it rather than if it's just online, at least right now. Do you think?
That's a really good question. I think it does feel different when you're actually there, but I think as soon as you start to close the loop and start to see people interacting with your broadcast online, live in real time, then that's when things really start to change and you start to be aware of that. And that simple ability for people to kind of interact back with you, I mean, besides calling into a station, there was no real way for people to interact with traditional radio stations. It was very much a kind of one-way street, right? Like
right.
It's the broadcaster broadcasting to the listener. And so now you have this possibility where actually, you could have online channel broadcasting with a chat room. If you post the show afterwards on Mixcloud, you can have people commenting on it. You can have them favorite it. They can share it on their social media networks. So there's a whole kind of extra conversation that's happening that previously you really weren't able to do. So I think that is kind of changing the dynamic a bit.
Well, here's something else. It used to be that when you did your radio show, it disappeared into the ether. After it was finished, it was gone, unless somebody happened to record it or you recorded it yourself. But for the most part, it was, you did it and it was gone. And now that's no longer the case. So now with Mixcloud and other services as well, now it becomes something that could stay perpetually. Does that change the way a broadcaster approaches things, do you think?
I think it does in some sense. I think that one important distinction, though, is to draw a difference between content and shows that are very much based around real-time live events and shows that are kind of more specialist music and potentially have very evergreen value. So things like, drive-time talk shows and news, sports, and weather, those probably aren't going to hold up and have many people who want to listen to them again the next day or even, a week later. Whereas some of the more specialist music shows that people put up on Mixcloud, some of those are still, worth listening to years, if not, decades later. So I think that it really depends on the type of content, but that ability also, you're right, didn't exist before. So that's definitely a change as well.
What's the primary content that's posted on Mixcloud, do you think?
A lot of it is exactly that. It's people who've done a live show in either a formal radio station, commercial radio station, community radio station, student radio station, or even just from their bedroom. And they want to archive it and give people their chance to listen to it again. Because a lot of times, people put in a lot of time and effort into producing their show, putting it together, curating the playlist and things like that. And, you know, the idea of it just existing once and being so ephemeral is kind of sad in a sense, nearly. So, yeah.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, definitely. Last question for you. What's the best piece of business advice that you either received from somebody in your career here or something that you learned along the way?
I think really one of the best pieces of advice that I've been given, and definitely trying to think about most, is really to kind of focus on building a great team first, because, you know, ecosystems evolve, things change, markets change, systems change, but if you can build a great team, then actually, you know, your team can evolve and adapt and change. And so we've definitely focused on that Mixcloud. And, you know, whilst we have a very small team, everybody we hire, we've been incredibly impressed by and really have meant that, you know, we can be quick and nimble and adapt and change. And, you know, if Facebook rolls out an update or there's a new, you know, iOS, you know, Apple rolls out a new iOS system, then we can be really quick and nimble and adaptable because we have such a good team. So, yeah, that would be my kind of top advice, really focus on getting the team right first, and then everything kind of follows.
Good advice. Thank you, Nico. This has been great. I appreciate your time. I enjoyed the chat. You can find out more about Mixcloud at mixcloud.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. He helps put the show together. Many thanks, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or find it in iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.